The Rules Committee will come to order, and I'll note for the record that there is a quorum present. First order of business is approval of the minutes for May 12th. Vice Chair Hollins, would you care to move the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Next order of business is the calendar for the day for Saturday, May 16th. We are proposing five bills, House File 3024, Hanson J., House File 4384, Bakeburg, Senate File 4339, Kraft, Senate File 3891, Myers, and Senate File 2373, Pinto, the Senate language. I move the adoption of the calendar for the day pursuant to Rules 1.21 and 3.33. The Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration will designate Saturday, May 16th for the adoption of the calendar for the day and establish a pre-filing requirement for amendments offered to those bills. Any discussion to the calendar for the day? Co-Chair Nisco.
Thank you, Chair Long. I urge member support.
I'll also note that since we're in the final days of session, we certainly would be open to supplemental calendar for Saturday if bills come up that we agree to. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The calendar for the day is adopted. Our next order of business is House File 4172, Cleavorn. And I move House File 4172 to get it before the committee with a recommendation that it be referred to the General Register. Representative Cleavorn, I believe you have an author's amendment, the DE1, so I'll move the DE1 to put the bill in the form that the author wants. Representative Cleavorn, would you care to explain your amendment?
Yes, thank you very much, Chair Long. The DE1 does several changes, two small, one significant. The bill itself is a legislative technology and office space use, and the intent of the bill is to clarify what can and cannot be done with legislative technology and space by members. You will see in subdivision one of the amendment, we include the word intern. The Senate evidently gives their interns email addresses, so in order to be sure they were not in violation of this proposed legislation, they inserted the word intern. Subsection 2, members' telephone numbers, we wanted to make two clarifications to match the Senate's concerns. So you will see on line 1.11 of the amendment, it says assigned to, and the word support was inserted by the members' caucus or legislative body. Previously, we said House. So legislative body made it clear that the intent was for the legislature. And then in the office space provision, subdivision 3, on line 1.15, it says to permanently or temporarily. The previous language said occupy an office, and there was some confusion in the state government committee, so we changed the wording to say to permanently or temporarily office, meaning to establish an office in space assigned to the legislature. And then the major change is in subdivision 4 in the enforcement piece. In the original language, it was the exclusive purview of the legislature, and the enforcement piece now would also include, if it were to go to court, the court would have jurisdiction. So subdivision 4 is a major change from the original language.
Any discussion to the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted, and Representative Cleavorn, please present your bill.
Thank you very much. I think it's important to, I'll walk through the language of the bill and say what it does, and then I will say how we got here. So the very first subdivision makes it very clear that email and telephones, no member, officer, employee, or intern of the Senate or House may establish a legislative email address or assign one to a person who is not a member, officer, employee, or intern of the House or Senate. So that's a prohibition. Subdivision 2, member telephone numbers. We all are assigned numbers to our House district, and this makes it very clear that the legislative telephone number assigned to the Senate or House of Representatives to a member is for the exclusive use of that member. If authorized by the member, an employee or intern who is assigned to support that member may also use that phone number. So, for example, our LAs can answer the phone for us. An intern could return a call for us. The office space piece says that a member, officer, employee, or intern of the House or Senate of Representatives is prohibited from allowing a contractor or other person who is not a member, officer, employee, or intern to permanently or temporarily office in the space assigned to the House without prior written notification to the leaders of each caucus in the relevant body, whether it be in the House or the Senate. So, for example, that would mean if the House DFL caucus wanted to allow a contractor to come in, they would need to notify the House Republican caucus. And then the enforcement measure says that the Senate and House of Representatives must adopt rules to implement this section, and that must also include remedies. But nothing in this would prevent a matter from going to court for adjudication. So that's what the bill does. Now, I want to just kind of level set the committee as to how I got to this legislation, because I think that's equally important. You have in front of you, the members of the body, something that's called a signature block. And the signature block is what tells the court who is representing petitioners or respondents in a legal case. In late January, I noticed the signature block in the quorum case, but this is not about the quorum case. I want to be really clear. This is not about the quorum case. But I did notice that individuals, two individuals specifically, had been given House emails, which is against our House IT policy. And so I was like, wait a minute, how did this happen? So then I thought, before I go too far, I'm going to see if these individuals had been hired either part-time or full-time by the House. So I reached out to HR for confirmation that, in fact, they are not House employees. I reached out to House IT to verify that our policy is for only House employees to receive House emails. That is our general policy. And then I thought, okay, well, how is it that they were allowed to use the second floor of the state office building? So I reached out to our controller to see if we had a lease agreement with these individuals to use part of our space. The answer was no, there was no lease agreement. So I thought, okay, I will check with administration to see if they offered a lease agreement and had entered into a lease agreement. There was no lease agreement between these individuals and the Department of Administration. And the Department of Administration was very clear to me that they were the only entity allowed to lease space in the Centennial office building. So then I reached out to find out what are the protocols and how were these emails granted. And the response that I received back was that they were directed by staff of leadership to provide these emails. And then I asked, what about the phone numbers? And they referred me to the sergeant's office because I thought telecommunications was all together. So I reached out to the sergeant's office to see if, in fact, this email had been issued to the, not email, but this phone number had been issued to these attorneys. And I found that, in fact, the phone number that these attorneys were using in their signature block to the court belonged to a member of our body. and it belongs to the district, the people of the state. It doesn't belong to us. As you well know, when I vacate this position, the exact same number that I have in the House will transfer to the very next representative for the district. It's not Jenny Cleavorn's number. It belongs to the people of 42B. So I said, fine, how do I deal with this information? So I reached out to see what, in fact, our code of conduct looks like. And our code of conduct is very old. 2007, I think, is the last revision of our code of conduct. And I looked to see what rules and procedures we had in place. And in fact, they're very, very weak. And then I looked to see what do we require of the Department of Administration, what do we require of the executive branch, and they have much more extensive rules. And so members, that's kind of where I am with how I got to the legislation. And I want to make sure that we are forward-looking in this bill. Because our House was in a unique time of conflict, nonpartisan staff found themselves in a very unusual position of not knowing what rules to follow and what rules not to follow. So this would make it very clear 4 years going forward, both in the House and in the Senate, in a very divided state, what can and cannot be done with House emails and space and telephone numbers.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. There were no submitted requests to testify, so we'll move to member discussion. And the first on my list is Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cleavorn, for bringing this forward. This is an issue that I would never have thought about, so I appreciate you bringing it to our attention. I guess my first question is there a reason we have to do this statutorily as opposed to through rules or any other means?
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Hollins. It's a really good question. I reached out to the legislative auditor to say, you know, what are best practices? And the legislative auditor told me that this legislation is important for putting in good internal controls and process. We currently have policy which would prohibit these things, but as you can see, it went forward anyway. So this is just a really good governance measure of clean internal controls.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, that's really good to know. I guess my other question is, because it is a violation of policy, is there any sort of repercussion in our policy outline for a violation of that sort of policy?
Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Chair Long and Representative Hollins. So in speaking with the legislative auditor, and I do not want to speak for the auditor, so I will use my own words. I understand that in order for this to be looked into by the auditor, I would have to have four-party agreement between House, minority, well, we're divided, right? So we would have to have four caucus agreement to have this looked at by the auditor, and we still might not reach a resolution. And then the only other place that I could see in statute where this might come into play was the very statute that we looked at on the floor the other night, 609, right? Is this misuse, right? But 609 takes us into criminal statute. And I felt it would be much better for us to look at this as let's clean up our own house. And so I felt the legislation was the better path to take.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. That makes sense, and it's future looking, which I appreciate. Uh-huh. I know sometimes violations can occur, and maybe people didn't even know it was a violation. So it's good to be looking forward and having this conversation. I guess I am a little confused as to why anybody would be trying to use a government email address as a lawyer. I've worked for law firms. Most law firms, and frankly, any reputable vendor has their own, you know, server, email account, phone numbers, office addresses. I just don't understand why a vendor would be trying to use any of the government, IT uses. I think it actually maybe hinders their credibility a little bit because, you know, if you are a law firm, one of the first things you do is actually get, you know, a domain name and make sure that you have an official email address. And I see that we've got that on the, you know, on the attorneys for petitioners with locklaw.com. So I guess I'm wondering if you have any answers as to why a reputable company or law firm wouldn't have their own information available.
Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you. I had the very same question myself, Representative Hollins, and I do not want to impugn motives. What I can tell you is that I went back and I researched two things. I went into the unofficial record of the period that this would cover, and I listened to the January 15th Rules Committee at that time. And at that time, a member was stated as saying that they wanted to ensure that there was no conflict of interest. Again, not imputing motives. I'm just saying that's what I found. And then I had another point I wanted to make about that. You are correct. And the lawyers, it's interesting. I went back then to see the lawyers who have their ID numbers on the pleading. So if you look at the very first lawyer, you will see the lawyer's identifying bar number there. And the bar number, then I looked up at the judicial branch, which anybody can do. It's public information. And in fact, all three attorneys were registered at a very different address. This was not the address that they were shown. And I reached out to the University of Minnesota ethics professor, Richard Painter, and I asked, what is the rule around signature blocks, and is this a normal practice? And I was told absolutely not. I was told that attorneys never use their client's address if you were to just assume that this was the client. But they always use their own address, and it is not normal practice, and the courts have rules and procedures about what needs to be in the signature block and how those attorneys need to be identified.
For the follow-up, Representative Hollins.
Thank you. I'm wrapping up. Less of a question and more of a comment, because that makes sense to me. That's been my experience as a practicing attorney. And I will say that what I see here as a risk is a risk of data and information from constituents going to attorneys that are not representatives, and also the other way around, where information about a legal case could potentially be received or intercepted in some way by constituents or people outside of that party, and that is very confidential information. And so I think that this is really good policy going forward. It's exceptionally needed. I do, you know, like I said, as a lawyer, I'm like, I don't understand why this would even come up, but I appreciate you bringing this forward because I think it's important, and especially to maintain that attorney-client confidentiality. You know, we don't want to ever put that at risk, so thank you.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Cleaborn. Thank you for bringing this forward. I'm sort of curious, you know, thinking beyond this sort of specific example that prompted this legislation, I'm curious if you sort of have other concerns for the public about sort of the kind of implication of association with a legislative body that use of these kinds of resources could imply.
Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Coulter. The piece that was most concerning to me was the confusion to the public. When I saw it, I readily identified the fact that these were not employees of the House. However, the general public would not know that. And the reason I put this on each of your desks for today is so that you can look at how confusing this would be to the general public. So you see on the left-hand side, Keith Ellison, Attorney General. Attorney General is an official state agency. So there you see the names of the attorneys, you see the state of Minnesota, you see a state business address, and you see a state email. And again, stating attorneys for Petitioner Simon, right? Also Secretary of State. On the right-hand side of the page, you see the three attorneys who were named. You see the Minnesota House of Representatives, Centennial Office Building. The address is incorrect, but it is still implying that is the Centennial Office Building. And then you see the attorney's name. And on other pleadings, you would see two attorneys' names with house emails and a house phone number. So I want to say the reason this is concerning to me is that when someone receives an email from the Minnesota House of Representatives, it carries the full credibility of the institution to say that the entire institution is behind this. They're speaking for the House, right? When you see our moniker, the Minnesota House of Representatives, it implies that this is sanctioned by the Minnesota House of Representatives. It appears to the general public that these three attorneys are actually state employees using state emails with state phone number. If an ordinary person were to read this and Google the address or the phone number or the email, they would see the cadence for the House. And that is misleading to the general public. And that is the basis of my concern.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer, Representative Cleburne. And as somebody who previously worked for another legislative body in this state that I will keep anonymous, I think that is a really, really important point. The trust and expectations that folks have of public employees, of public resources, like emails and phone numbers and office space. So I'm glad you mentioned that. The other question I had for you, I've not been sort of as in the weeds on a lot of this as you have been. So I'm curious, would this qualify as fraud or at least misuse?
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. I want to be careful here because I don't want to cast aspersions on any member of our body. What I would say is that in hearings that we have held in this House, whether it relates to fraud or misuse, I would say if I, Jenny Cleburne, had a business outside of the House and I gave my colleagues House email addresses and I allowed them to set up shop in a state office building, someone would want to hold me accountable for that. So the purpose of this legislation is to set really clear guardrails that going forward, that is not allowed. I can tell you, I have been in this body for 8 years now. If I would have walked into IT and said, I would like a house email for my bestie, I can assure you that would not have happened. So the fact that this was done at the highest level of our body is concerning to me. It is a very slippery slope. As a mediator, I have said for years, pay attention to the details. And so I'm paying attention to the details, and I am making sure that we clean up our practices so that no one falls into that behavior.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Chair Cleburne, for paying attention to the details. This is pretty important.
I have the details.
Yes.
Wait, I forgot the third one. Yeah, no, I have the details. Yeah.
Some of my questions were already answered, so I guess I'll just make a point, which is, I think if you just sort of asked the body, like, what's standard practice, I think the very safe assumption would be that this type of thing would not be allowed, would not happen. And, you know, sometimes an event happens that causes you to say, like, I guess we need a guardrail or a safeguard that we didn't know we need. But I think given kind of the what you've portrayed here and given us some information and the questions kind of makes it clear that we do need something like this. And I also appreciate how we're talking about this in terms of what I think should be, no matter your party, something that we want to do is protect, you know, the integrity of the institution and protect our legislative IT services and office spaces. And so for that reason, I think it's a good bill for us to be on the record on, together on. And so I'll request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Any further discussion? Representative Steer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question on subdivision 3. Can you define what temporarily means in this?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Steer. And that could be a day. The intent is office, to establish an office. So it doesn't matter if it's for one day, or if it's for 15 days, or if it's for 15 months. No one except the individuals assigned to that space by their caucus or by the administration should be using it without notification of both caucuses.
Representative Steer.
So would that include family members of the representative? So if for instance, a son or daughter or wife that long session night would go and sleep in the office, would that be temporary or not?
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. And this was the question that Representative Quam had, which caused me to clean the language. So you're certainly your family who's here visiting you because of over 50 miles away. If they want to nap in your office, totally fine. They can use your office to nap. What your family member cannot do is establish your office, assigned office space, as their place of business to tell outside individuals that this is where they work. That's what we mean by to office.
Representative Steer, follow up.
If we're just, if we're still working on this, I mean, would it be possible to add family members into the mix for the office space so that it's not an issue? If I guess we're not going to do that. Okay, thanks.
Sounded like that was a comment. Representative Cleburne?
Yes, thank you. I would say no. If the intent is for family members to be able, I mean, we work in a public space, right? The public is able to come and go. Our family members are public entities or people, right? So they can come and go into our office, and you can allow your family member to come in. And even in our technology rules, it allows for, you know, an incidental use of space, right? If you were trying to move your family in to the office building, I think that would be a problem and an abuse of space.
Co-Chair Niska.
Well, thank you, Representative Cleburne. Thank you, Chair Long, for this opportunity to go down memory lane and remember a problem that was created by 66 members of this body violating the statutory obligation to show up for work on the first day of session. I guess I'm curious, Representative Cleburne, whether in your research into the time when you were not showing up for work, whether you determined whether the individuals on this sheet there was an effort to hire them as part-time or temporary employees of the House.
Representative Cleburne.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and Chair Niska. One, there has never been a time since I was sworn in January of 2019 that I have not worked for this body or this institution, and I have always shown up every day for my community. So I would ask that you please not impugn members. I have been very delicate in how I have presented this bill, and you more than anyone know that. What I would say to you is, yes, I have read all three retainer agreements. And in those agreements, it does not provide any provision for office space, telephone, or email. Those retainer agreements are now, as you well know, null and void, but they do not require anything of this body to provide for them in that regard because they have their own offices, spaces, and telephone numbers. I would also say that those retainer agreements state clearly that it is the entire agreement between the individual, Lisa Damath, who signed them, and the attorney who signed them.
Coach Nisca, follow-up.
Thank you, Chair Long and Representative Cleavorn. I think you didn't really answer the question, but what is...
excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Let Coach Nisca finish
this. Yes, you mentioned that there was confusion about this being, about these representing the House of Representatives. In the research into the period of time when you were violating your statutory obligation to show up for the Minnesota the Minnesota House session, did you become aware that the Attorney General's office considered the lawsuit in question to be a lawsuit against the respondents, including myself, in our official capacity, and offered to represent, and the Attorney General's office offered to represent us because it was a lawsuit against the House in its official capacity?
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you. I knew that this was going to happen, that the conversation would be confused. I stated very clearly at the beginning that this has nothing to do with the quorum case. This is a forward-looking piece of legislation to provide clear guardrails for the individuals who may occupy these seats after us, that we all know that it is not prohibited, or it is prohibited to allow our district phone numbers, email addresses, and office space to be used without being an employee of the body.
Representative Nisca.
Thank you, Coach Long and Representative Cleavorn. I think the point is that what you've identified as the problem is based on factual errors resulting from your failure to actually be here at the time you were here. And I'm reminded that Chair Long had, I think, his second press release that he issued this entire session is a press release that still remains on the website containing false claims about myself. So again, this bill is a solution in search of a problem. It's an effort to relitigate something that I don't know why you want to remind people that you didn't show up for work for 23 days. It's super bizarre, this bill, the fact that we're having this hearing, a solution in search of a problem. I urge members to vote no.
Any further discussion? Representative Cleavorn, we'll let you have the last word.
Yes, thank you very much. And I will use not my own words to close, but I will use the words of Professor Painter. Professor Painter said, and I've asked for permission to use this quote, the official channels of communication of the state of Minnesota should not be used for advancing a personal, a political, or political agenda, whether it be that of individual members of the House of Representatives, employees of the executive branch, or his own colleagues at the University of Minnesota. Members, this bill is really an important guardrail. It keeps the integrity of the body intact. It allows the members of the public whom we serve to know who is and who is not an employee of the state. And when they receive a letter from the state of Minnesota, they know that it is in fact coming from an employee of the state of Minnesota legislature. When they receive an email from someone in the legislature, they know that it is in fact an employee of the legislature who is contacting them. And when they call a phone number, they know that they will be in touch with their representatives, not someone else masquerading as an employee of the state of Minnesota. It's an important piece of legislation, and I ask for your yes vote.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. I will just note that I agree that this is an important piece of legislation, and it seems like it's a hard concept to debate or dispute, which is that you need to be an employee or otherwise designated category to be able to receive official email, official phone number, official office space. And we do have examples of this being misused, and Representative Cleavorn was very specific about that. Ironically, the case itself proved, Representative Nisca, that Democrats were in the right and maintaining the integrity of this institution and standing up for the election results and standing up for our constituents, and that Republicans were using the House as if it was their own, and it is not. It is an institution that is for the people, and it is for all representatives. And if you are going to represent that you are on behalf of the House, then you should be an employee of the House. And that is, I think, a pretty straightforward concept. So I fully support this motion, Representative Cleburne, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Long?
Yes.
Chair Long, aye. Chair Niska?
No.
Chair Niska, no. Vice Chair Hollins?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hollins, aye. Vice Chair Schultz?
Nope.
Vice Chair Schultz, nay. Representative Allen?
No.
Representative Allen, no. Representative Coulter?
Aye.
Representative Coulter, aye. Representative Frederick? Aye. Representative Frederick, aye. Representative Howard?
Aye.
Representative Howard, aye. Representative Jacob?
Jacob, no.
Representative Jacob, no. Representative Jordan?
Aye.
Representative Jordan, aye. Representative Cagle?
Aye.
Representative Cagle, aye. Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Nash, no. Representative Purcell?
Purcell, aye.
Purcell votes aye. Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Scott, no. Representative Steer?
No.
Representative Steer, no. Representative Zelesnikar?
No.
Representative Zelesnikar, no. Mr. Chair, there are 8 ayes and 8 nays.
There being 8 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail. Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Members, that is our business, and we are adjourned.